Revenue for Monday, May 14th, 2007. Will come to order, and we will do a public hearing. We'll open a public hearing now on Senate Bill 777.
Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 777, as amended, extends the sunset date for a 10-year partial exemption from property taxes for the rehabilitation of housing or the conversion of buildings to housing. The proposed sunset date is 2017. It will provide that the rehabilitation improvements must be executed within 2 years of the initial application. Under current law, the exemption is January 1, 2008, and I don't believe that there are any major requirements about how much must be done within the first 2 years. This adds a little bit more accountability to the bill.
Okay. Thank you. And we have Barbara, I'm not sure of the last name, and Ann.
Hi.
But you know who you are.
Yes.
I'm Barbara Sack from the City of Portland, the Portland Planning Bureau, and this is Ann Johnson from the Portland Development Commission. We're sort of a pair here.
Wonderful. Please proceed.
Okay. We appreciate this opportunity to present testimony on behalf of the City of Portland and the Portland Development Commission on Senate Bill 777. This bill would extend the sunset date of the rehabilitated residential property tax exemption, which is in ORS 308.450, to the year 2015. It would also clarify application and cutoff dates, thereby improving the administration of the program. Under the authority of the state statutes, the City of Portland adopted a 10-year limited rehabilitation property tax exemption program that is administered by the Portland Development Commission. This statute was enacted by the state in 1975 to help local jurisdictions maintain their rental housing stock. The City of Portland adopted this program as part of the implementation of our downtown housing policy. At that time, there was a lot of rental properties that needed rehabilitation. Excuse me. The ownership component of this program was added by statute in 1989 and adopted by the City of Portland to support neighborhood revitalization in parts of North, Northeast, and Southeast Portland. These areas are known as distressed areas. You have a map there. They're the areas in blue. Portland has changed the name of these areas to home buyer opportunity areas, but the criteria for designating them is that they're low to moderate income areas where there's bad housing conditions that this program is helping improve, and that's why the owners in those areas can apply for the property tax exemption. The goal of this program is to encourage the rehabilitation and improvement of properties in different areas of the city that have existing code violations by providing a 10-year abatement on the increased value that results from the property improvements. It's not an abatement on all the property taxes, just that increment that's due to the improvement of the property. The owner continues to pay property taxes on the assessed value of the land and the original improvements. The program provides an incentive for owners to make major improvements to their property, improvements on a scale that would increase the assessed value of their property and would otherwise result in a property tax increase without the abatement program. By providing this incentive, property owners become the city's partner in carrying out revitalization plans in key areas of Portland. Over the past 5 years, the City of Portland has issued 55 tax abatements. There are currently 100 active tax abatements because this lasts for 10 years. Over the life of the program, the city has abated taxes on 422 properties that have supported the rehabilitation of more than 2,400 rental and ownership housing units. On the technical side, properties must have a code violation to be eligible. Owners of properties under 25 years of age must spend a minimum of 50% of the property's assessed value on rehabilitation renovation, and properties over 25 years require a minimum of 5%. We brought with us maps that show the location of both the owner and rental properties that have received the benefit of this program since 1997, and also identify those home buyer opportunity, which are in the state statute's distressed area boundaries. The extension of the sunset date will enable local jurisdictions to retain a valuable tool in our revitalization kit, and it will also allow the City of Portland to develop new strategies to link with other city initiatives to complement this program, so we're supporting the bill. As you know, in the City of Portland, poverty is moving east, so as housing conditions change over time, there's more areas in the central city that get taken out of this program and more that get added to the eastern portion of Portland where there's some deteriorating conditions in the residential areas. So if you have any questions, Ann can talk about the map and can answer any technical questions. I can answer questions about housing policy and the history of the program.
Thank you very much. Did you have testimony today as well?
No, I'm just here to answer any questions. If you had questions on how the program is actually administered and advantages to the people who do qualify for this program.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The map that you've provided, is this program only eligible within the home buyer opportunity area boundaries, or is it
the owner-occupied?
And for the record, would you state your name,
please? Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Ann Johnson, and I'm with the Portland Development Commission. And the owner-occupied program is only available within those areas. The rental program, because it carries a very long it carries an affordability agreement for the length of the tax abatement, is available anywhere in the city. So all the black dots that you see, those are all rental units that were done prior to 2003. Mm-hmm. And so those are why there are lots of dots outside those specific green areas.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
How is the homebuyer opportunity area boundaries determined, and how often are they changed?
I can answer that. We determine the homebuyer opportunity area boundaries by looking at a number of things. We look at median income. We look at housing values. We also do a visual survey of these areas to look for areas where there's deteriorated housing. We don't have the number of vacant and abandoned homes that we did back in the late 80s and early 90s, but there's still some pretty there's some areas of Portland that are in poor repair, and actually in the eastern part of Portland you are seeing boarded up houses. So that's how they're determined. No more than 20% of the city can be designated as a distressed area. The Planning Commission adjusts these boundaries every 3 years after holding public hearings.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at that map as well. And is there any to these rental properties that are where the black dots are? These are tax-abated properties. Everywhere there is a black dot?
Yes, because the rental properties are not restricted to the home buyer opportunity areas. That is available anywhere in the City of Portland because it carries the affordability agreement with it. So,
is there a minimum size to these?
I don't believe there's a minimum size. Generally, they are multiple plexes that carry other kinds of financing that carry a restriction to it because most owners of rental property are not willing to do restrict their property, the majority of the units, to 60% or under if they don't have some other reason that they are doing that. So it is available if you want to do a renovation to a rental property anywhere, as long as you're willing to sign the affordability agreement that lasts for the length of the tax abatement.
And a final question, Mr. Chair. So could you describe what that affordability agreement consists of?
It depends on the size of the units, how many of them have rent restrictions on them, but generally it's someplace between, I don't know, I haven't worked specifically with those, but there's specific things in the law that say what the restrictions as far as the rent is. They are restricted to under 60% of median. They have to be affordable to people under 60% of median family income.
That's low income. That's the standard for low-income housing. And the percentage of the units, I believe in larger projects, it's 20% of the units
have to be.
And then it gets adjusted actually upward, I think, as the, you know, if you had a duplex or a triplex, a larger number. So it would be, would have to stay affordable for the length of the tax exemption.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was also looking at the map and wondered if you could comment on what sort of outreach efforts are made, and I'm wondering if in some of these designated areas it looks like it's considerably less participants, and whether that changes over time.
Well, it does change over time because particularly the east side ones are relatively new, and so they haven't existed nearly as long as, say, some of the ones that are in the central northeast area where the tax abatements have existed since the very beginning. So I think part of the reason that you see fewer in the east side area is that there simply hasn't existed. I don't know when we changed. I think 2 years ago they changed the and added many of the areas in the east side.
Yeah, the east side areas are very new. When the program first started, some of these east side areas hadn't been annexed into the city of Portland yet. Also, a lot of the properties are in north and northeast. And this was a program that was probably publicized a lot when we did the Albina Community Plan, which was a revitalization plan for inner north and northeast Portland.
Follow up.
Yes,
sure. So do you expect that they will, you're making outreach efforts to those newer areas?
Yes.
We're also going to be taking areas out of northeast Portland that are improving. This time when we changed the map, we took some of those areas out and we added areas on the east end. Originally, this program also included some areas of inner southeast Portland. They've been taken out. So as neighborhoods improve, we take the areas out because it's meant to be a revitalization tool and it should be targeted to the low and moderate income neighborhoods.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, this is probably a question for staff. We've talked about this program in Portland. The bill, I think, speaks to statewide, unless I'm missing something. Is there any other city that is using this, or what are the restrictions?
My understanding is predominantly in the Portland area.
So no other jurisdiction has this program that you know of?
Not that, well, there may, but maybe you change.
It's permitted,
right.
But they have not set one out.
That is correct. Sure. There may be a few, but the predominant numbers that I'm estimating for the impact are based on probably the majority of the dollars come from the area.
Mr. Phillips, head shaking, is agreeing with Mary.
Oh, only one.
Thank you.
That was the question I was going to ask, so it's been answered. Anything else for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony and bringing of the bill. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 777 today? I don't see anyone. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 777. What's your pleasure, committee? Is this ready to work?
Mr. Chair, just confirmation, is this a refix vote or just an extending the sunset, a majority vote on the floor?
I think this is a majority vote because it doesn't have an effect on state revenues.
Okay, thank you. Just confirming.
Yeah. Are we ready to work the bill, you think? Okay, we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 777. Colleagues?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rosenbaum?
I move Senate Bill 777A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 777A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Berger?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I noted from the map that my daughter and her husband do not live, but they live very close to the neighborhoods impacted here, but I don't have to declare a conflict because they've been taken out, or they never were in, or I just checked them out. They're not in now.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Anything else? Please call a roll.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative
Brown. Aye.
Representative Butler.
Excused.
Representative Gelfer.
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Green.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. Okay, the bill having achieved the required majority goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier? Is there a reason why this can't go on the consent calendar?
Oh, yes.
There's a reason why it can't go on the consent calendar.
You're probably
the most familiar with the area. That would be good. Representative Rosenbaum will carry the bill. Thank you very much. Mary, your other bill. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 653.
Senate Bill 653 permits tax-exempt entities, such as a religious organization, to have property receive an exemption if it's been subleased from a taxable owner. Under current law, an exempt organization, let's say, could lease from a taxable owner, but it can't, and the exemption would be passed on to the property owner if he made the savings available to the religious organization. But it doesn't provide that same exemption if it's a sublease. Follow that? Really, it's sort of a real minute aspect of the legislation. But also, there was another Senate Bill, 816, which proposed the same thing, provided an exemption if the sublease was from an exempt owner. Well, the chair in the Senate Revenue Committee requested that perhaps we combine these things into one bill. And that is the purpose of the Dash 1 amendment. It brings them all together. So if an exempt organization has a sublease with either a taxable or an exempt entity, the owner of the property will have the exemption allowed, and then if he passes that benefit on to the organization. And that's what happens under a lease now.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
Welcome.
Thank you for coming back to visit us again.
It seems I'm getting around the building, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Senate Bill 653 I dropped because of an issue that arose in Eugene and OHSU's piggybacking on my bill. And I'm okay with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, but I am circulating an email I just received at 10 minutes to 1 this afternoon that folks believe there is a conflict in the amendment, that it doesn't really mesh together quite nicely. So Mr. Dempsey and I have been out in the hallway. He's been talking with his attorney, and we believe that after we present the bill, we need a little bit more time to try to make sure that these amendments actually gel the way we do. I don't object to his amendments at all, but I just want to make sure it works. Why I dropped the bill is because there's an organization in our community called NEDCO, Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation, and they are a nonprofit, and they moved into office space, entered into a sublease with Rainbow Valley Design and Construction, who bought a building last summer. When they entered into the sublease, they applied to the county for the property tax exemption for the space, and they were denied the property tax exemption because the Oregon Revised Statute does not allow for subleases. So that's actually why we're here. John Van Landingham, the guru who helps out on all things landlord-tenant and also wonderful other things about land use in Oregon, was helping, as well as the Community Development Law Center in Portland and the Association of Community Development Organizations. So we all put our heads together, and that's why you have 653 that fixes that small little problem. And I think Mr. Dempsey will tell you his small little problem and why he wants to piggyback onto my small little problem.
Thank you, Senator.
I'm Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jack Dempsey. I'm with Oregon Health and Science University. We're here to support the Dash 1 amendments, which mirror Senate Bill 816, which came over from the Senate and is in your possession right now. It's a very similar issue to the one that Senator Walker has. What it does, it allows a nonprofit or government entity that subleases to another nonprofit or government entity to carry over that exemption to them. It's very similar. Talking to our attorneys, it does sound like the way the amendment's drafted is that it conflicts with the original bill. Don't ask me to explain how that works, but it's my understanding we need a different amendment to this. And I also have Mary Kennedy, who is our planning director, with me today, that can cite some examples if you need them.
Thank you. Questions? Yeah, Representative Berger.
I guess I'm not as familiar with these landlord-tenant laws but who determined, how was it determined that sublease doesn't count but lease does? It seems like a pretty fine point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it would be you. The legislature We make up the ORSs, and in the ORSs, we drafted them years ago, these particular statutes, and things have come along differently, and we don't allow for subleases, just that it just doesn't work under the code. So that's why we're here, so that you can be among those great, brilliant legislators who fixes this problem.
Can I pursue this?
Please.
Yeah, okay.
I think I have the same problem you do.
I didn't make this decision, but I guess, I mean, we've been going on all these years with this, and all of a sudden somebody said a sublease is not a lease, or was there a statute somewhere, and I'm not reading the repeal of anything in here, that specified that a sublease is not here, or did some courts say a sublease is not a lease, because a sublease seems like a lease to me, but as I said.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess that's the
that's
part
a good
of my
question.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, on June 19, 2006, NEDCO, the organization that I was talking about from my community neighborhood, Economic Development Corporation, received a letter from the Lane County Department of Assessment and Taxation that denied their request for the property tax exemption. In the letter, the county asserted that ORS 307.112, quote, doesn't allow a sublessee to qualify for exempt status, end quote. And so therein lies the problem. And when you go to Oregon statutes, they're interpreted on three levels of analysis. One, the text and the context. And two, the legislative history that we all lay out in committee and on the floor. And three, the maxims of statutory construction. And if it sounds like I'm brilliant, I'm not. This was written out of a memo that I'm reading from that a certified smart lawyer wrote. So the problem is the courts have to follow the plain language of the statute. And Lane County Tax and Assessment decided that this wasn't correct, and NEDCO would have had to have filed an appeal and go through the tax court. And I'm not sure that they did, because I think we just decided to file a bill and take care of it.
What do I get?
Thank you. It does seem to me, Representative Berger, that this is an overly concrete interpretation of the statute.
Yes.
A sublease is certainly a lease.
Yeah.
And a agreement, a property that's used by the lessee in the manner, if any, required by law for the exemption of property owned or being purchased by it, should apply to the use of the lessee to sublease the property to somebody who's tax exempt. I mean, I would think those would be obviously included. But if somebody else doesn't think so, we have no choice but to go and fix it.
We like fixing things, Mr. Chair.
We do.
We specialize in fixing things.
That's, thank you, Senator. That's exactly right. I've been looking at the testimony from Oregon Health and Sciences University, and I guess we have some others to testify on that, so I'll save my question. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Okay.
We appreciate testimony, and we also have Tamara Miller and Mary Kennedy.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll continue to work with Mr. Dempsey on this, and we'll bring it right back as soon as we can get our ducks in a row.
Thank you.
And I'm going to excuse myself if I might, because I have another bill in another committee.
Thank you very much.
Chair, that's particularly appropriate from Senator Watson, getting her ducks in a row.
Yes.
Particularly today.
Yes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Mary Kennedy, and I'm Director of Planning at OHSU and deal with leases for the institution. So if you have any questions, I'm available.
Why don't we hear from Ms. Miller, and then we'll ask questions for both of you.
My name is Tamara Miller, and I'm the Property Services Administrator for Peace Health in Eugene. And I'm testifying in support of the amendments to Senate Bill 653. Peace Health is a long tax exempt organization. We provide health care services to the community. And we ran across a problem that this bill fixes last year when we had property which had previously been exempt. We had an internal financial transaction which produced a sublease. And when we applied for to continue the exemption on the change, we were denied. This is property that was previously tax exempt and was considered to be exempt, were a qualified organization, and would have been granted exemption if not for the fact that we held the property under sublease. I urge your support on the amendments to Senate Bill 653.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
I have one or two. In the examples, Ms. Kennedy, that you presented in your memorandum, the very last one, is it the last one? Maybe the one before that. No, it's the one before that. Is Tuality Healthcare, is that a nonprofit?
Yes, it is.
So Tuality Healthcare, the Department of Orthopedics is subleasing space from Tuality Healthcare. But even though both OHSU and Tuality are nonprofits, that space is subject to the property tax.
That is right.
Okay. It does appear that much of what you're concerned about is covered in the original bill, the sublease provision in the original bill, Senate Bill 653. Although it may be that the amendments needed for something that I don't quite understand. But thank you. Are there other questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'm still not clear what the problem with the amendment is. And reading from this email from Tad Eberhardt, it says, at worst, it could be interpreted to provide that sublease property can be exempt. How many subs do we get to before we get to the bottom of this?
Well, my view of this particular issue is that what we ought to have in the statute is a requirement that says if the organization that's making use of the property is a nonprofit and therefore entitled, if it owned the property, to a tax exemption, and they're getting a rental consideration based on the fact that the owner is not paying the property tax, then they ought to get the deduction based on that. And it shouldn't matter what the form of the rental agreement is, whether, you know, you're the sixth person in line or whether you're the first person in line or whatever it is. It shouldn't make any difference as long as the nonprofit is getting the benefit of the tax break rather than a for-profit owner. And that would be my sense as to what we'd like to have in the statute. I'm not sure that even this statute, bill accomplishes that, but maybe it does.
I will be. I just can't wait to hear the end of it.
Yeah. because otherwise you get caught in these traps where you're making business decisions that are based on the use of space that makes sense, but because of some technicality in the law, what would otherwise be a nonprofit use suddenly isn't exempt anymore. I'm getting head nods, so we must have gotten it right.
No, I think, yeah. I get it.
Anything else for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 653? Not hearing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 653. Colleagues, it's apparent that we need to wait for the amendment. So we'll do that. And our last item for the agenda today, before we get to that, Representative Rosenbaum.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended in order to allow Representative Gelster to vote on Senate Bill 777.
Representative Rosenbaum moves that the rules be suspended to allow Senator Gelster to vote on Senate Bill 777. Representative Gelster, boy, I'm doing it, aren't I? We get a senator in here, and suddenly everyone is demoted to senator. yeah. Anyway, are there objections to that motion to suspend? Seeing none, Representative Gelster, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Gelster votes aye on Senate Bill 777. We have the last item on our agenda is a public hearing on House Bill
2592. And, well, these are from Friday, and this is from today. All right. Is that Senator Buckley? Oh, yes, Andrew, come forward, please.
Name's Andrew Ainsworth, and I'm here for Representative Buckley, who's chairing the House Education Committee currently. So I will be reading his prepared testimony that he was set to deliver last Friday. Chair Barhart, members of the committee, today I bring you House Bill 2592, a tax compliance bill that was first introduced last session. House Bill 2592 ties up a number of loose ends in the realm of tax collection, but my primary interest in the bill can be found on pages 4 and 5. As you're well aware, many of our counties recently lost funding from a federal subsidy that they had received in lieu of timber receipts. In order to fill the resulting funding gap, many local governments may choose to institute a small local income tax. In sections 6 through 12, this bill allow governments who may choose to do so to request that the Oregon Department of Revenue collect those taxes on their behalf. And the collected funds are then placed into a local income tax collections fund that is continually appropriated to the department for redistribution to the respective local government entity that instituted the tax. And this could become an important tool for our local governments attempting to fund vital services for their citizens in these rough times. I have brought you a number of amendments. The dash ones, dash threes, and dash fours are all from Representative Buckley. And let me explain the thinking behind each one. In each of these amendments, I've included a provision to raise the percentage cap on the rate of tax that local governments can request the Department of Revenue to collect from 1% to 3%, mainly just to give local entities more leeway in these difficult financial times. The Dash 1 amendment was originally crafted after some discussion with Representative McPherson, who's one of my co-sponsors on the bill, and it was crafted to slim down the number of provisions in the bill. Since my primary focus is on the collection of local income taxes, I originally felt that the inclusion of the first three pages of the bill made it a bit too bloated. However, after discussing the provisions on those pages with individuals who are more knowledgeable about tax law than I am, I reconsidered and had the dash three and fours drafted up. So I would urge the committee not to adopt the dash one amendment. Sections 3 through 5 of the introduced bill address a longstanding problem. More often than not, this is what I am told, but non-residents selling real estate they own in Oregon fail to pay taxes on the sales of those properties, and then collecting those out-of-state debts costs the state significantly more than if they were to be collecting in-state debts. And the most effective solution is to withhold taxes on real estate sales by non-residents. This is what the Dash 4 amendment does. It tweaks these provisions in the original bill, changing it a little bit. It requires authorized agents to withhold taxes on the sale of real estate controlled by non-residents and remit those monies to the Department of Revenue. It also gives the department the authority to collect these funds if they are not withheld and remitted. Additionally, it also prohibits deeds and mortgages from being issued unless the specified amount has been withheld. Jody Weiser is in the back of the room here from Taxpayers Oregon to speak a little more specifically about these changes, as once again, I'm not an expert on tax law. And I would urge your adoption of the Dash 4 Amendment. However, the Dash 3 Amendment has been introduced in the event that the Dash 4 is not palatable to the committee. It may be a little difficult to move out of the committee, I understand that. So if the Dash 4 seems to be dragging down the future of the entire bill, I would urge the committee to adopt the Dash 3. It entirely eliminates the provisions on withholding non-resident real estate sales from the bill, but does leave in the collection of local income taxes, which is my primary focus in the bill. So I would prefer to see the Dash 4s adopted, but would settle for the Dash 3s if the committee is hesitant to recommend the withholding. And I'd be more than happy, Representative Buckley would be more than happy to work with the Senate Revenue Committee to make any additional changes if you guys, or if this committee would feel interested in just moving the bill out with the Dash 3s today. So again, I thank you for your consideration, and I urge you to pass the House Bill 2592 with the Dash 4 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I can attempt to answer any questions with my limited knowledge on the subject.
Thank you. Are there questions for Andrew?
I note that this has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay.
And I think the reason for it is because of the provisions in Section 11. There's some couple of blanks in the bill that need to be filled in by somebody, and they certainly appear to be the sort of things that might make sense there, because it has to do with the collections, local income tax collections fund in the state treasurer's office. Thank you very much.
All right.
Let's see. We also have Jody Weiser.
Jody Weiser with Tax Grants Oregon. The last time we spoke about this bill, I said that that there were 15 states that currently withhold, that we know about, that currently withhold on out-of-state sales, and that two that we're doing reporting only have...
Real estate sales.
Real estate sales by out-of-staters, yes. And but that they were had discovered some loopholes that taxpayers are, reticent taxpayers were finding. And so what we attempt to do with the Dash 4 is fix some of those loopholes. The first is that we had individuals and corporations in the first bill, and this adds other entities, because that was one of the loopholes. They would just transfer to an entity the ownership and then sell. The law allows if you go to the department, you would pay tax only on your net rather than on the gross, which is in the bill. And taxpayers were developing new mortgages so that there would be less net. And so the amendment requires that any mortgages be at least 6 months old so that there wouldn't be sale anticipation mortgages. Same thing happened in Colorado. They would form a in-state Colorado LLC, transfer the privately held property to the LLC, and then there wouldn't be withholding. So this law requires that the LLC be more than 6 months old as well, so that that loophole would close. Obviously, if somebody really wanted to not have withholding and they had their head together, they could get their LLC organized and everything, then still, I mean, the really reticent taxpayer is going to find a really good way to do it. But as I said before, Montana found when they went and looked at all of their out-of-state sales, 70% of the taxpayers, the should-be taxpayers, were not reporting. Woman who runs the program for Maryland, which this is kind of crafted after, I said to her, so do you have help? Do you have an assistant? She said, that's pretty much me. And I said, so you're bringing in, it looks like about $5 million a year. She said, no, actually, it's more like $20 million a year. And I said, what? Because that's not what was on their website. And she said, well, the website only talks about the direct withholding. But what we're finding is when taxpayers come and they want to, they would withhold 9%. Our bill withholds 4. So taxpayers don't want their full income tax withheld. They come to the department and they go, well, look, here's my basis and here's my sales price. And she sees that it's a rental property and she goes, well, you haven't filed taxes for any of the years that you owned this property. So they're catching the people who weren't paying taxes on their income from the property during the years of ownership. And as their use of the bill has proceeded, some taxpayers were just going ahead and having the full amount withheld, but then they were filing tax forms that asked for the full amount back, saying they had no that they had no gain. She's an auditor, and she's auditing all of those tax forms, and that's where some of the money is coming from. I don't think we could anticipate necessarily that kind of gain, because we're not the same state. And you'd have to have the same personality and the person doing the job, probably. You know, that's kind of how things go. But it seems to me that those are things that are important to pay attention to. And they found that having to have the taxes paid in order to get the title transferred is a pretty effective way to make sure the taxes are paid.
Thank you very much. Questions for Jody? Representative Berger.
Questions, but I don't know if Jody's the right person to answer.
Ask away and we'll find the right person.
I There's a lot of things in this bill, and so far we've only talked about one portion of it, and I wonder if we're going to have other testimony on, for instance, the section on state agencies, boards, and commissions that issue occupational professional licenses, who would administer that, what that looks like. I have a lot of questions on that might have a huge fiscal that I don't know about. And the same with the 1617 DOR adopt rules requiring payers of a specified type of payment. I'd like to know more about that. I don't know where you're going with this, Mr. Bill, but there's Mr. with this bill, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bill.
Mr. Chair, where are you going with this bill? Not Mr. Bill. But I hope we're going to hear from those folks. I'm a little confused. I don't have a dash 2, but is it the dash 4 the only one that is under consideration? Is it the one that I should pay attention to?
I think, Representative, what we ought to do is get a small work group to look at this bill and trim it down to the tax compliance issues that we feel confident about. Leave the others for another day. I understand that the sponsor of the bill wants to do something with the local government income taxes, and maybe we can figure out how to do that. I have to say that as I looked at this bill, the thing that interests me about it is exactly the thing that interests Jody about it, and that is this tax compliance piece. If we're actually leaving a lot of money on the table because people simply aren't filing their tax returns and paying their taxes, that's something we should take care of. But you've raised some very good questions on other portions of the bill. Yes.
And Mr. Chair, you'll note that I am a sponsor on this bill, and I similar legislation last session I was part of the discussion of, and I'm very happy that we are discussing it further. But I will say there are questions around those issues, but by my name being here, I don't want to imply that I'm buying wholesale everything that's in here by any stretch of the imagination. And so I do appreciate further work on this bill.
Well, I think this is an important enough subject that even though we're very late in the session, it is worth another go around. We have a couple more witnesses, but then maybe we can talk about setting up a work group to take a look at this and pull the pieces apart and maybe figure out what pieces we can pass easily through the House that, in fact, may generate a substantial number of dollars, as I understand it, as we're looking at it, that we certainly could use and that, in fact, the scofflaw should pay.
I'll say something about the license portion of the bill. It's totally permissive in nature, and an agency may ask the department to see if their staff or the people they license or whomever their audience is tax compliant, and the department may respond. So it doesn't set up any requirement at all. And under current law, Oregon Revised Statute 305.385, the department has long had the authority to use licensing information to verify that license holders are taxpayers. As far as we can tell, they don't really use that authority. They have it in place. So they could, if they chose, be right now requiring that everybody in the state that gets a license to do business of some form, you know, as a masseuse or an attorney or a doctor or whatever, if they would verify that they were tax compliant. And a number of states to do that, but that's not an authority that they have been using. So it's just another way to go about the same kind of permissive thing, and probably it's, you know, this may be a point where the legislature needs to say shall rather than may, and if they said shall, they definitely would have an economic hit because it would cost money to do that.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Jack Monroe?
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jack Monroe, here today speaking on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. And has already been indicated, at least the two sections of the bill that I'm going to comment on are identical to sections that were discussed last session. And those two sections in this bill are Section 4 and Section 15, which Section 15 being the whole agency board commission issue that Representative Berger has raised. Certainly, the Oregon Land Title Association supports the primary objective, which is promoting task compliance and curbing abusive avoidance schemes. But we believe that there are significant problems in both of those sections. And let me deal first with Section 1. And to the extent that I can, I'll weave in what I know to be the two or three amendments that are out there and before you. I know Mr. Warner will be very quick to counter the comment, but my recollection from the last time was that, in fact, these two sections were projected to raise very insignificant revenue if adopted. But I don't know if a new statement's been put together. Section 4 of the bill directs settlement agents to withhold up to 4% of the sales price for remittance to the Department of Revenue when a non-resident conveys real property. And the interest, obviously, of the Land Title Association is that I think as those of you who have conveyed or purchased real property know almost all of those transactions go through escrow, and escrow agents are, in almost all cases, title insurance company employees. So, you know, obviously, any such requirement would impose new responsibilities on the companies. But we think there are a number of ambiguities that exist in Section 4 and therefore create some significant potential liability for inadvertent noncompliance. Let me deal not with a definitive list of what we would consider to be the issues that are here, but at least some that are representative. The basis for the withholding calculation is in fact in the printed bill unclear. It's 4% of the consideration or the net proceeds, and if I use a very simple example, probably the simplest, which is a cash sale, no mortgage involved, etc. One of you were to purchase something, let's say 4 years ago for $200,000, and you're selling it today for, let's say, $230,000, you would have closing costs, let's say, including a commission of $20,000 and $10,000 as a capital gain. In a cash sale, the consideration would be the entire amount, and so you might have tax liability of less than $1,000, but you'd be withholding over $9,000. Certainly a related question would be, who makes the decision about what might count against gross proceeds? If, for example, there were unsecured lien holders, would paying that lien holder or those lien holders reduce the net proceeds to zero and therefore negate the need to do any withholding? We think that withholding will impair a number of kinds of transactions that are out there. You know, you do exchanges, and this would obviously get in that way. You have workouts when you've got property that's impaired, where the current owner is in financial difficulty, and if you're withholding a sum, then it's very difficult to deal with that impaired financial situation. The bill includes in the list of things a variety of events, some of which are in fact taxable events and some of which aren't. I mean, getting a mortgage is not a taxable event, and yet it's part of the definition here of an act that triggers this withholding. And I guess if you were in fact were to want to deal with loans, then the question is, you know, again, what's the calculation? Is it the entire amount? What are the net proceeds in a refinance? Leases also sometimes go through closing, and in fact, people acquire title insurance on long-term high-value leases, and so certain of those funds would go through escrow. And what's the correct holding? Is it the first month's rent? Is it a value of the lease? Who knows? The closing agent here would be responsible for making the decisions with regard to, for example, whether a corporation is doing business in Oregon. And yet there's nothing in the bill that suggests, a temporal guideline there. Is it, what is immediately after? Is it the next instant? Is it a week later? Is it a month later? Is it within the same calendar year? How does the closing agent determine whether the corporation does not maintain a permanent office and staff of at least one employee in the state? All of these are real-life considerations that have to be dealt with. Obviously, one of these amendments apparently attempts to deal with whether or not this applies to business entities other than corporations, but the bill is printed is silent with regard to whether it deals with partnerships or limited liability companies or business trusts or other business entities. The bill also requires withholding in situations where it clearly wouldn't be appropriate. If a nonprofit out-of-state entity, let's say, picks up a piece of Oregon property as a bequest, there isn't going to be any tax liability, but the withholding process would apparently apply. So there are a number of issues, and all of those issues obviously would be resolved by the adoption of the -3 amendments, which delete Section 3, I think, which places it in the statute, Section 4, which is the guts, and I think Section 5 is a effective date provision. So if you choose to move forward with the measure, and I realize that there are a number of other ideas in there, we would certainly urge that you adopt the -3 amendments prior to doing so. The other section that I would comment on is Section 15, and Representative Berger raised some questions there. Basically, it deputizes agencies, boards, and commissions that occupy or that grant occupational and professional licenses, and they're deputized to perform tax compliance duties. Interestingly enough, I don't think any evidence has been presented to suggest that lawyers or doctors or any of the other folks that are out there necessarily non-comply at a higher rate than those who don't have such licenses. But it seems to me that there are a couple I think it's a questionable public policy decision, but I also don't think that the way in which Section 15 is structured makes much sense, because it provides these boards, commissions, of which there are well over 100, there are in the excess of 260 occupational licenses out there, which would include the ones that would probably leap immediately to mind, like doctors and lawyers and CPAs, but it also includes tattoo artists and my personal favorite, pony persons. But it includes, obviously, a wide range of different boards and commissions that grant occupational licenses. And it empowers those agencies or those commissions to make tax compliance a factor in the either granting or the maintaining of a license without really, for example, any definition of what tax compliance is. So, I mean, you could have 100 and some different standards that are out there, and that would not seem to me to make particularly good sense. I think the other issue that you would have to wrestle with, you know, tax information is obviously among the most closely guarded information that I think our public agencies, and in this case the Oregon Department of Revenue, maintains. And I think I don't know which licenses anybody here might have, but let's just say somebody was a real estate agent. I'm not really sure that you would feel personally comfortable if you had a real estate license in knowing that the real estate board or whoever the board is has your personal tax information. And so I think for those reasons, among others, this is an idea that you probably ought to think very carefully about. Now, it does give the Department of Revenue a role, and they can develop what they consider to be rules for tax compliance. Interestingly enough, doesn't require, at least as I read it, doesn't require any of those 100-plus boards and commissions to necessarily adhere or adopt that definition of tax compliance. So I would, I guess in closing, I would urge you, if you're going to move the bill, to move it with the -3 amendments, and I don't think there are a set of amendments to deal with the Section 15 issue, but that's one you'll have to wrestle with, I guess, on your own.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Monroe? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Deborah Buchanan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. It is a complicated bill. It's difficult to know exactly where to start with this. The real estate withholding provisions of the bill are something that our staff has looked at, and we believe we probably could implement this as it's written in the bill. We would obviously need to do some rulemaking and establish a process to do this, but we think we could do it. As has been noted, it does apply only to individuals and corporations. I would also note that on page 3 of the bill, in lines 36 and 37, withholding is not required if you have a non-taxable exchange, which is something that you may want to think about, and if you were to adopt this, we might be back in the 09 session to deal with non-taxable exchanges. The reason I say that is that Oregon is somewhat unique among the states in that if a person does a like-kind exchange of Oregon property to out-of-state property, eventually that gain is going to be taxed by Oregon, and that occurs when they have a federal taxable disposition. So I believe that could be the reason that Montana reports that they have such a high rate of noncompliance, is Montana has a similar provision in that it says that if you exchange Montana property for property, for example, in Wyoming, and that's a non-taxable exchange under federal law, that when you dispose of that Wyoming property in a taxable sale, a portion of the gain is reported back to Montana. And I believe that there are probably a lot of non-residents that aren't aware of that provision. Oregon has a similar provision. So even though the bill itself says that non-taxable exchanges won't be subject to withholding, there is a tax obligation that's associated with that acquired property.
Is there any way of implementing of that? There's no automatic implementation of that, is there?
Mr. Chairman, no, there's not. What happens now is that taxpayers who have a like-kind exchange and acquire out-of-state property file a form with their Oregon return. It's called a Form 24 to report to us that they have engaged in that transaction and the amount of gain that's eventually taxable. But there is no withholding requirement. There's no lien that goes on the out-of-state property, no bonding requirement. It's simply that they need to know that they need to report that gain in the future when they have a taxable disposition.
But if they forget to do that, either literally or figuratively, there's no way for us to find out. Is there no reasonable way?
Mr. Chairman, it would be a question of us tracking that and contacting the taxpayer to say, do you still have that property? Have you done a taxable sale? And you're right. There's nothing that the taxpayer really is obligated to do except report the gain and pay the tax eventually. You might remember when federal law had a rollover of gain on a sale of a personal residence. It's much like that, that you could have a deferral build up over 10 or 20 years. Very often when people changed accountants, that deferred gain was lost along the way. So a similar situation here. So that's the real estate withholding.
Representative Berger.
Before she goes on to the other section, can I engage in...
Yes, please. I'm doing it. You might as well.
Yeah, on this particular subject.
Yes, please.
I think she's going to go on to another position. Deborah, this is new to Oregon. Surely it's not new to other states. Are you aware of model legislation? Or I think Mr. Monroe brought forward a whole bunch of unanswered questions around this, and I guess... my question for you is, are other states answering these questions? Are you aware of how this is handled?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'm not intimately familiar with them. I have done just a little bit of research. There are other states. It looks like the original bill to me is similar to what Colorado is doing, and California also has real estate withholding requirements. I don't know that those other states have similar laws around like-kind exchanges, because the ones that I have looked at exempt like-kind exchanges from the withholding requirement. So we have a little bit of a difference there. But leaving that aside, if the provisions in the original bill are enacted, there is a requirement there that an agent obtain a written affirmation by the seller if they are exempt from withholding. And I noticed that Colorado has a similar provision where the person who's doing the selling is on their honor to say, we're not required to have withholding. There may be problems and ways for people to get around that, but that's true of any tax law. And if we were to have this enacted and implement it, I think we would probably be back to say, here's what our experience has been, and here are some areas that we think you might want to look at making some changes to make it a little bit tighter. But as a first step, I think we could probably implement the provisions in the bill.
And one of the things that Jody Weiser raised was the possibility that you might discover other taxable incidences that weren't reported as a result of a report of the sale. I think she mentioned the possibility that somebody might sell a rental property, an out-of-state owner might sell a rental property upon which they had never and had never filed an Oregon income tax on the income that they'd earned on the rental property as a rental. Is that the sort of thing that might occur in Oregon if we had a rule like this?
Mr. Chairman, I would expect it would. The advantage of this is that there is either withholding required, which then comes to the department, or there is an affirmation that needs to be filled out and signed by the seller and presumably sent to the department saying we're exempt. So in either case, information is coming to the department, and I think that's one of the keys is we're getting the information either through withholding or either through a report saying we're exempt from withholding. And that, I think, is a big part of the compliance.
Thank you. Please go ahead. You had other comments about
that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could speak to the licensing provisions in the bill. You may recall that there was a bill last session that Representative Butler had, I believe, sponsored and did go through the House side. It made it to the Senate Revenue Committee where it died with these, I believe, the exact same language around the licensing. It is permissive. It does allow the department to work with other agencies. What I would expect we would do is identify areas where we think that there is significant noncompliance with licensees and work with agencies that wanted to work with us. I would expect that we would adopt rules saying what is tax compliance. We would not, however, share tax returns with boards or agencies. All they would need to do is contact the department and say, is this person in compliance? And we would say, yes, they have filed returns, or we don't have returns for this period. And I think that would be it. We wouldn't need to divulge all of the tax information. I would speak to Ms. Weiser's comment about our current authority. We do license revocations now. It is a fairly involved process because we're taking away someone's livelihood. But our first goal, obviously, is to get them into compliance, get them filing, get them paying the taxes. License revocation is not the first thing that we do if we find that someone's out of compliance. So we do work with them and try to get them back in. So we do take advantage of the current authority. And if there are questions about that, I'd be happy to try to answer anything on that particular piece. Mr. Chairman, if I could go on to the other withholding provisions in the bill. I'm not sure anyone had particular questions about this, but in Section 17, it's very broad. It gives the department very broad authority to specify when withholding would be required. What I think we would probably do with this is, starting in 2011, Congress has passed a provision that requires state and local government to withhold 3% for federal tax and remit that to the federal government of nearly all payments to contractors or vendors. I would think at that time, if we're withholding federal tax, it probably might make sense to withhold state tax on those same payments and remit that. So that could be one example. Or if we find, again, that there is a widespread noncompliance in a particular category of payments, we might be able to use this require withholding there.
And what year is the federal requirement going to
be? I'm sorry, it begins January 1, 2011, and that was in the 2005 legislation. I know that there are lots of concerns about that being an unfunded mandate for the states, and there's opposition to it, so it may be repealed by then, but that's current federal law.
This deals with a subcontractor issue then, doesn't it? This sort of
contractors or vendors.
Or vendors. If I'm building a building as the owner and I have a general contractor, under this provision, could you require me to withhold payments to the general contractor and remit the money to you?
Mr. Chairman, if we adopted rules that said that, yes, I believe we could.
Okay. That's essentially what this is about, isn't it? Something, I mean, that type of situation.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, before I get to the local tax, I just did want to comment on the pension withholding provisions that are in Section 1. I know no one spoke to this, but just to point out that non-residents who are no longer domiciled in Oregon are not taxable on their pensions by Oregon. So if I, when I retire and am entitled to receive my state pension, move to Washington, Oregon will not be able to tax me on that pension. So it really, does it make sense to withhold on my pension when you're not going to be able to tax me? And then you simply force me to file a return to get a refund of the withholding. So that's just an administrative piece that I wanted to point out.
And could you point out where that is in the language of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, on page 2, lines 34 through 36, prohibit making an election to not have withholding on.
Oh, I see.
Amounts. And finally, Mr. Chairman, on the local tax, the department realizes there is a great deal of interest in doing this. Current law does allow us to provide services to local governments that impose an income tax. What we have looked at are various ways to make that simpler and make it work. And what is in House Bill 2592 may not be the best approach. It mandates that we put that on the state income tax form, which could actually end up being more costly and less effective than other ways to assist in collecting the tax. It sounds simple, and it seems like all you would need to do is add a line and take a percentage of an amount. But when you consider that some taxpayers will move into or out of a jurisdiction during the year, some may move into one area that imposes a local tax from another area that imposes a local tax, there may be three or four different counties that want to impose a local income tax. And then the questions are, how do you get all of those things onto the state income tax form? One thing that we have considered doing is sending out a return, just like you get an electric bill or a telephone bill, saying, we've looked at your state income tax return. Based on that information, we've calculated a local income tax for you. If it's right, please send a check. If it's wrong, please make the corrections and recalculate the tax. So that might be one thing to do. We could do a standalone tax, as is done with the Multnomah County Business Income Tax, I believe is standalone. We used to administer that. We don't do that anymore. The Multnomah County Local Income Tax was standalone, administered by someone else. So we're very aware that local governments want to find solutions, but we are just a little bit concerned about the strictness in the bill itself and what it would require us to do to make that work. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those were my comments.
Thank you. Are there other questions for the department? I don't see any. I'm wondering if the department would be willing to work with a small work group to work on these issues that you've raised to see if we can get this bill into shape.
Mr. Chair, we would be delighted to do that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. If there's nothing else, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill, unless someone else would like to be heard, on House Bill 2592. Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2592. And we've completed our business for the day. We've got 45 minutes to go work on other things.
Mr. Chair, are you going to have assigned a group in on that?
Yes. Well, we probably should have left the public hearing open, so we'll reopen it. Who would like to work on this? You are one of the sponsors of this bill.
I am, Mr. Chair. I thought, oh my goodness, another thing added to my plate. I'm not sure. I'm willing to do that, but I don't have a lot of time right now in my schedule to delve into some of this.
Okay.
I think that Representative Reed, however, is the smartest guy in the room, and he could speak for me on these issues.
He follows the rule that would allow someone to think that, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, I really wouldn't mind getting into it.
Representative Olson?
This one, too, as well.
Okay. All right.
Representative Reed's going to do it.
You two want to work together with Representative Buckley and... Mm-hmm. And with the department, and maybe Jody and Mr. Monroe, and see if you can hash out some of these issues. And what I'm thinking about is this: as we talk about this, we're not going to get this thing perfect. The real estate withholding piece is not going to be perfect. There's an obvious amendment that needs to be made on Section 1 in order not to capture people who aren't subject to the tax at all. It looks as though Section 15 was worked before, but you may want to take another look at it. And Section 8, of course, appears as though there's things in it that are overly restrictive of the department trying to work the thing through so that it will actually accomplish what we need to accomplish. And those are probably my comments based on the testimony that we've heard today. And I'm thinking this. The bill is complex, and it's got a lot of sections in it. If you get to the stage quickly, in a very short order, where you don't believe that you're going to be able to write an amendment that will work for the next couple of years, then dump the section out altogether. I hate to say that because I'd hate to lose some of these pieces that I think might actually allow for some compliance work that we need to have done. I have to say, Mr. Monroe, I particularly attracted to Section 4, the one that you like the least. I would say that there are several pieces in this bill that might be beneficial for us, and that if you can bring us back an amendment that will allow us to pass some bill, we'll send it over to the Senate. If the Senate, and what I would say to Senator Deckard at that point, and the members of his committee, is that if there are pieces of the bill that once that we get it there that they simply can't live with it, that they amend them out and will concur in what's left. That would be my suggestion as to how to proceed with the thing, given the amount of time that we don't have.
You're setting us up for success, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'm trying to. Now, Section 11 is an interesting piece because it sets up this special income tax collection fund, and I suspect that that's the reason for the Ways and Means referral. If there's a way of accomplishing the job without setting up the special fund in the treasurer's office, we might be able to remove the Ways and Means referral and thus save some time to get the bill passed. Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your approach on this. I'm sorry that I feel like I don't have the time to get into this. This is an omnibus bill from last session, and there's so much in here that there's lots of good ideas, but they are not fully vetted. And this late in the session, I do appreciate your direction on this, and that's part of the reason that I'm, you know, not ready to delve into this late right now. But I do appreciate that you put this on the record.
I appreciate your comment, and I would just say further that that if there's only one section of the thing that you think we can get ready on, it's still worth passing out that one section. That has to do with tax compliance. It will bring more taxpayers into compliance. That may actually raise a little revenue for the state and make it a little easier for people to sleep well at night because they know that they're in compliance with the tax laws. Anything else? With that, we'll close the public hearing, and we'll close the... tomorrow morning. Don't forget, tomorrow morning, we're meeting at 8:45 with the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. I'll get it eventually. To hear the report of the state economist on their revenue projections for this quarter, or for the next, and the next biennium. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.